You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of April 2016 on Monocle 24. Who will win Syria's election? Why is Israel so annoyed with Bernie Sanders? Are Islamic State really a laughing matter? I'm Andrew Muller. Midori House starts now. On today's show, Syria, parliamentary elections at home, peace talks abroad. What is the point of either exercise? Daniela Pellad and Robert Fox will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including Bono's diverting idea for defeating Islamic State.
I'm suggesting that the Senate send in Amy Schumer and Chris Rock and Sacha Baron Cohen. Thank you.
Can comedy and satire really have a useful role in the war on terror? All that and more coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House, and my guests today are Daniela Pellad, Acting Managing Editor for the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Robert Fox, London Evening Standard's Defence Editor. Welcome both back to the show. We will start today with Syria, which is today holding parliamentary elections. These have received little coverage in the global media, almost as if the result is something of a foregone conclusion. At the same time, peace talks have resumed in Geneva, about which one could be forgiven for harbouring a similar fatalism. Robert, we will start with the elections first. They are obviously a nonsense. They're only being held in government-held areas of Syria. The opposition, such as it is boycotting, and plus it's an election in Syria. So why is Assad bothering to hold them? I mean, it's a day out, obviously, but other than that.
I think he's strengthening his position with the Russians. Actually, I'm sorry, you're wrong in some of the assumptions in your question. Because there's a lot moving in Syria, which is very worrying. Because the script to even get to some stage of negotiation based on a ceasefire seems to be going off the rails. Because from several quarters, we hear that fighting is likely to resume. Assad, with his Iranian backers, is saying, I am not going to go. Now, it appears that Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, didn't expect this. They thought that they could parlay the Assad clique and these very powerful Palestinians, as well as Alawite families round him, that they could parlay them to make it some sort of transitional regime.
Because this is still Russia's official position, isn't it?
Yeah,
There will be a transition.
What we are discovering, and actually there's been some very good writing in New York Times and from the region and in the Financial Times, actually he is giving his version by these elections, particularly in the propaganda that goes with it, his version of Louis XIV, l'état c'est moi. The state is me. It's the Assads. You cannot have Mr. Putin, Mr. Lavrov, Mr. Russia, what you want without the Assad clique. Not only clique, but cornerstone. And the arch falls down. That's what's going on, I think.
Daniela, do you think that's the case, that this is Assad reminding his allies in Moscow, as well as his enemies everywhere else, that as far as he's concerned, he's not going anywhere?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt about that. And the timing is not exactly incidental either. But I disagree. I have no doubt that Assad will go eventually. I mean, Syria is not Assad. Assad is not Syria, as much as he would like that to be. And the Russian interest in Syria is not personal. At a time suitable and fitting, Assad will go, most likely, I can imagine, be gracefully retired somewhere where he can live out his days. But there has to reach some point where one side, some actor, has got enough leverage, and we haven't reached that yet. And again, you're right, Andrew, the elections are just as symbolic as the peace talks. Perhaps the peace talks have a better reading on the international stage, but we're absolutely nowhere when it comes to the. Well, are we on the third? Is it the third UN envoy? in 5 years.
They are racking them up at this point, yes.
It's a good sign. It's a good sign when people have enough of sort of plum UN jobs and hold their hands up and say, well, no, actually, this one we can't solve right now.
Robert, is it possible that if this is a snub to the Russians, that it might be a snub that was cleared in advance, as it were? I guess the question I'm asking is there any real reason why, if Russia gets what it wants from Syria, whatever that may be in the long term, is there any real reason why Russia would want Assad to go? I mean, it is, from their point of view, it is surely, presumably, vastly better the devil you know and the devil who owes you something.
I don't think so. I think that they probably, I'm with Daniel here, I think that Assad will have to go, because the Assad propaganda is saying that he can put the state together again, or enough of the state that you really want. Where I follow the argument that Daniel has put forward is that you're not going to ever win the support of the majority Sunnis for Assad, given what has gone on in the past four years. That they're trying to clean up the act at the moment. Let me explain. The Russians are trying to sort of de-Assadize the army at the moment. They're stepping down his extremely violent kinsman, Macher, who has been using special commandos and the 4th Division, and he's been pushed to one side, rather as his father, Hafez al-Assad's, you know, his hard man, wild man brother, who's still alive, by the way, Rifat, was moved to one side. But I think that this is where the picture really does look very ominous, because I agree with Daniel. I don't see the talks within a month of Sunday, so certainly within the month of 2016, making any progress whatsoever. And meanwhile, you cannot isolate this thing. The picture is looking so very, very difficult in Iraq right now. And if you get the ceasefire crumbling, going back to war in Syria, and this tremendous problem that even Allied success is producing. It's producing some sort of success in areas in the Sunni heartland. I'm now talking about Iraq. And yet there's nothing to come behind. It's exactly what we had before. And it led to the tyranny of Maliki. And Maliki is still around. I mean, the mess in Iraq, which we have been distracted from by Syria, now is looking extremely ominous again.
I think with the peace talks, I think it's important to bear in mind the international community is far from interested in pursuing a genuine peace deal and a final resolution and so on and so forth. I think right now they would be more than happy with the kind of frozen war that we see in so many other places around the world. Most importantly, as far as the Europeans are concerned, somewhere in Syria that they can send refugees back to. That's how low the expectations are. I mean, last week we saw a resumption of fighting in Nagorno-Karabakh, although the worst for more than two decades. Now, the human cost there is grave. The last round exchange of hostilities, many soldiers were killed. And that's a very good example of an intractable conflict that has a peace process, theoretically, that doesn't go anywhere, but it's something that the international community can live with. Syria is on a much larger scale, but I think the international mediators can only dream of reaching that kind of level of frozen conflict.
Okay, well, let's look now at a perhaps slightly more meaningful, if somewhat more protracted, electoral process, i.e. the one for the presidency of the United States. New York holds primaries on Tuesday, a huge prize for all candidates, none more so than Bernie Sanders, who would emphasize his legitimacy still further if he gave Hillary Clinton a fright in the state she once represented in the Senate. He may therefore have picked an unpropitious time to discuss his opinions of Israel with local media. An interview he gave to the New York Daily News last week prompted one former Israeli ambassador to the US to accuse Sanders of uttering the blood libel, no less. Daniela, I've read Sanders' remarks to the editorial board of the Daily News. I'm not sure where it was he said anything especially outrageous.
He said one thing, which he got enormously enormously wrong.
This was the factual error about which he said at the time he wasn't actually sure he was right.
Yeah, they're right. He said that he believed that around 10,000 civilians were killed in the Gaza war in 2014. Now, not only is this a hugely inflated figure, I mean, even Hamas did not claim that this many people died. I mean, the figure, 1,500 or so civilians are thought to, believed to have been died, including more than 500 children. That's bad enough.
It is, well,
as it stands. Just to say, to throw that 10,000 figure around shows that he was really woefully misinformed. And I think this is what worries people, that he doesn't have a grasp on the conflict and its complexities. And he just basically opened up an avenue for people for attack very, very easily. And that was a strategic mistake, I think. Not that anything else he said was particularly controversial at all.
It's very interesting. I'm just reading through the transcript that the verbatim, that the editorial board with whom he was discussing this hadn't a clue either.
Well, there have been so many rounds of violence, lose count.
It was about Operation Protective Edge, which
that was the 2014 war,
a 51-day thing. I mean, I can't disagree with a word that Danielle has said. I mean, this is the thing that is so worrying. As a Brit that has spent a lot of time, working in foreign places, including quite a bit in the Middle East, not much in America, I must say, and I've put my hand up for that, is how ill-informed the debate is coming up with the wild assertions. You just don't have to go into Trump country. We know where, we're all quaking and in fear of our lives, Brussels, Paris, and occasionally London when he's particularly got it in for the Brits. But the point I think that we're inferring from this is that Hillary really will look a bit of a pro, because what has been acknowledged rightly is the Clintons' commitment. Clintons both to Israel. They take it seriously. They engaged with Netanyahu. They were rather better at it than the present incumbent, than Obama. But, I just do not know about the cephalological pond of the parish by parish electoral dynamics of a state like New York, nor any state. I've only been to the state five or six times in my life, and I really put my hand up for this. And I really don't know how this stuff plays, but I do take Danielle's point. It is thoroughly unprofessional. This is a guy who can't command his brief or isn't in command of his brief, and surely he should know you cannot make a wild assertion like that in these circumstances, and given New York, given the Jewish presence in New York, it is very strange. But I do see Hillary on the whole as a beneficiary from this.
I mean, Sanders, as we were saying, did freight his remarks by saying he wasn't sure of the exact numbers. He clearly just took a wild guess and he got it exactly wrong. The exact figure, according to most analyses of Protective Edge, was that around 2,250 Palestinians were killed, more than 10,000 injured, which, as you said, Daniela, are numbers perfectly high enough to make those kind of points with if you wish to make them. But given that Sanders was wrong, and even if he acknowledged he was wrong, are various Israeli voices making more of a thing of this than it actually is? And if so, why would they be doing that?
Undoubtedly. I mean, the current Israeli government is clearly far further to the right than most of the electorate in America.
Most of the electorate in Israel.
No, sadly not. The Jewish community was largely votes Democratic and so on and so forth. And research that I've seen says that Israel is really not on their top list of priorities when it comes to choosing a candidate. What Sanders has done is shown himself to be unprofessional. Clinton is professional. She is a pro. She has plenty of experience. She's had long dealings with Netanyahu. I have no doubt that she loathes him. He's not been an easy person to deal with for, consecutive American presidents. But the fact is that Israel is a key ally of the US, in the Middle East and globally, no matter who is in power in Jerusalem and no matter who is in power in the White House. And that's a relationship that has to be worked on. And it's as simple as that. It's not about the enormous power held by the lobbying groups or the evangelical right necessarily, but Israel is popular in America.
Just a final thought on that one, Robert. Do you get the sense that, and you mentioned there that Barack Obama is clearly less invested in Israel and the Middle East than several of his predecessors, and I think that's because he's made the political calculation that there's really nothing to be gained from getting involved in it, especially when you already have a Nobel Peace Prize. And I think there is also an element of that personal animus that clearly exists between him and Benjamin Netanyahu. But do you get the sense that US support for Israel is maybe no longer quite the rock solid given that it once was?
I think it's still pretty given. And I'll give you one or two examples. And I agree with you about Obama. You know, strategic detachment is carried to a point of genius by him. And what is thoroughly unprofessional is for him to have allowed his kidney, his personal dislike of Netanyahu, to be so prevalent. The key new bit of kit that's coming on, and it's very important, it's a very slow introduction, is the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter. In the region, the only key ally that is going to pick it up in first generation, and there has been no question about this, is Israel. Things like that, the military alliance, the military understanding and the intelligence exchange, in my daily beat, I see no change in that whatsoever.
And I guess same question to you, Daniela. Do you think that alliance does transcend any considerations of who is in charge of either country at any given moment?
In a broad sense, but of course, personal relations have an awful lot to do with it. And I don't think it's a support. The alliance is strong, but support for Israel from Washington isn't unquestioning. It's it can give support and it can take away support. But then for that, you would need a president in Washington with far more engagement and vision when it comes to foreign policy.
There's one very important element in this, though, in the relationship, which is part of the tangle, and it is the pressure by certain elements of the Jewish lobby against the deal with Iran. And there is a great deal of concern about Iran. And in fact, to triangulate it, the three points of the triangle, part of the huge problems of Syria and Iraq, are Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Israel. But I do not see, whoever is Secretary of State next, whoever the new president is, I do not see the alliance. I don't see the cord being cut with Israel or reduced in any way at all, because actually they need each other. And Israel, by the way, is a tremendously important importer of military expertise into the Western alliance, particularly the US and the UK.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Daniela Pellet and Robert Fox. Coming up next, seeing the funny side of Islamic State.
We're raising the curtain on a brand new show here on Monocle 24 devoted to the best in cinema. Tune in every week to hear from filmmakers, critics, and luminaries of the genre as we shine a spotlight on everything from revivals and the restoration of vintage cuts to Hollywood's golden age and the role of the auteur.
I never think of architecture or cities or landscapes in cinema as merely being a kind of neutral backdrop to the action. They are the action themselves.
Hear feature-length interviews with the biggest names, roundtable discussions, special reports, and more as Monocle 24 delves into the rich history of the silver screen. The Cinema Show on Monocle 24, in association with Mubi, premiering Fridays at 20:00 London time, because life is too short for bad films.
And you're welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Daniela Pellet and Robert Fox. Now, so far, at least, Islamic State have proved tediously impervious to reason, threat, or large-scale violence. Is it time we tried something else? Appearing, for some reason, before a US Senate subcommittee yesterday, Bono, out of U2, suggested trying mockery instead of drones and special forces. Here's what he had to say.
If you look at National Socialism and Daesh and ISIL, this is the same thing. We've seen this before. We've seen this game before. They're very vain. They've got all the signs up. They're really, it's show business. And the first people that Adolf Hitler threw out of Germany were the Dadaists and the Surrealists. It's like you speak violence, you speak their language, but you laugh at them when they're goose-stepping down the street, and it takes away their power. So I'm suggesting that the Senate send in Amy Schumer and Chris Rock and Sacha Baron Cohen. Thank you.
Robert, you've travelled in more than a few tyrannies and police states, I'm sure. They are all implacably humourless places. Does Bono have half a point here? The tyrant fears mockery, doesn't he?
Half a point, yes, absolutely right. And they dislike satire, and you know that and some tyrants are their own satire, not to say Satan, Nero, for example. But I don't think Bono's right about the fall of the New Order and the Third Reich. I think 20 million Russian deaths might have something to say about it. Actually, it's. I would like to be sort of take a thing out of Groucho Marx. It's right, really. You know, it's not show me mockery or whatever. I think it's a bit of self promotion going on with Bono there. Take me to the accountant is really what the question you want to ask, because it's the money that's really upsetting ISIS at the moment, and there is a big change, and it is changing, and it is under pressure undoubtedly in the heartland. So God knows what is going to come out of it. Can I talk about Mr. Bono? Mr. Bono had a field day yesterday. He'd written a huge piece in the New York Times explaining how you solve the refugee question. Oh, come on, give it a break. And he came up with ideas that were around 5 years ago.
Look, at least he's trying. Daniela, there is clearly a difficulty that fanatics have with being laughed at, which we saw expressed, I guess, most savagely and horribly last year with the massacre at Charlie Hebdo. Is there perhaps some way that sensitivity of theirs could be usefully exploited? Should we be making more effort to make fun of these people?
Absolutely. I never thought I'd say the sentence, but in this case, Bono is more than half right. Mm. And people are already doing this. I mean, he is perhaps a little bit of an old fart and unaware of this, but you know, the social media is rife with memes on Islamic State. I think, was it last year, they had this whole thing of replacing the faces of Islamic State fighters with ducks?
I'm a huge fan of the Islamic State karaoke Twitter feed.
Exactly.
As well.
Wonderful. They did it on Al-Qaeda too, very successfully.
Indeed, so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is, the reason it works on ISIS much better is because, of course, their famous professionalism when it comes to image and media and social media in particular. This really works. I agree that there's no replacement for military force. I mean, the Charlie Chaplin didn't manage to single-handedly defeat Hitler, in fact, make any kind of dent in that at all.
But it's still wonderful.
But it's happening. It's happening. Islamic State's finance is one thing. The other thing is its recruitment, a way it appeals to young men looking for some sort of glamorous, exciting, semi-apocalyptic future. And that's where satire is an enormously strong force. But I don't think they need Amy Schumer. And I'm very fond of Sacha Baron Cohen. But again, you know what? There are an awful lot of Syrian and Iraqi comedians who are already doing this.
At no small risk to themselves.
Exactly, exactly.
That's what's absolutely terrific, is what's coming out from these people. These people, God knows how they do it in Raqqa, that get these tweets and these messages out, and very, very interesting and illuminating they are too.
And I think, you know, I think this is something that the Western government should also try and pursue as well, because at the moment very much...
Western government-sponsored humour.
No, okay, fine. But what they're doing now, humour by committee, what they're doing now, though, that it's all about, and certainly the State Department is doing this, it's all about funding the counter-narrative, which not only, I think, sort of legitimizes the ISIS narrative. But is there anything so dull and unappealing as a counter-narrative? Humour, really. Humour and mockery and satire and duck's heads on ISIS fighters' body is really, really the way to go.
Just a final thought on that, though, Robert. I think instinctively you're right that as soon as any official involvement tries to motivate...
Bono's almost official now.
Very nearly is where the whole thing dies. But There is precedent for this. America did bankroll during the Cold War. It did send jazz bands and abstract art to two of the Warsaw Pact countries.
Oh, come on. You're going to make me weep tears of sentiment and nostalgia.
this wonderful essay
done by the Marxists of how to read Donald Duck. You're talking about the cultural imperialism of the Disney studios. Yes, there is a lot of truth to that. You know, the American soaps in the 50s with which they bombarded the burgeoning television of Latin America. Absolutely right, yes.
Do you remember how popular Leonardo DiCaprio's Titanic haircut was in Afghanistan in the Taliban era? Need I mention that?
I remember it. I was there, and they were wearing rah-rah skirts. This was in 1989, as the Russians left. The girls working in banks before they did all wanted to be Kate Winslet.
I can remember as late as about 1995, the entire country of Georgia used to shut down when Dynasty was on. And this is like Dynasty from about 15 years earlier. Like, seriously, you could fire guns down Rustaveli Prospect in Tbilisi.
Gaddafi's
Libya
power.
And Dallas. Pirated from the Italian television.
I have absolutely no trouble believing that at all. We should move along just to our final item tonight, which is the latest illustration of the eternal wisdom of Noah Cross in Chinatown, to the effect that whores, politicians and ugly buildings all become respectable if they last long enough. Into the latter category falls the neon Pepsi Cola sign on the foreshore of Long Island City, which has been designated an official New York City landmark. Daniela, can it's a hoarding. It's a billboard. Can it be said to have artistic merit?
Yes, it can, because it's old and stylish. I don't think the 1980s rebrand of Pepsi Cola would do the same thing. This is lovely, sort of like cursive handwriting. Very, very nice. Something iconic on the River Thames of my own beloved home city of London. The Oxo Tower was built at a time when they weren't allowed to advertise, so they just put an OXO in their building in the shape of windows. Now an iconic building. I don't think that it's particularly helped boost sales of meat broth, but it looks good. It's an Art Deco landmark.
I think myself of the, having grown up largely in Sydney, the huge Coca-Cola sign at the intersection of William Street and Darlinghurst Road in King's Cross is one of those things people actually assume is now some sort of official national landmark, but I don't think it actually is.
The Hoover building on the western approaches to London, not as in J. Edgar, but sucking up a lot of crap. It's absolutely wonderful, and it nearly went, because there was an equally wonderful one, Art Deco as well, Firestone, just on the route to Heathrow Airport, and the builders got in it and just smacked the lot. It was a temple of commerce of the 1930s. Actually very stylish, rather beautiful.
I'm sad enough to know that the Hoover Factory was once immortalised in song on an Elvis Costello B-side. I forget what it was actually a B-side of.
Oh, God, let's go away.
I'm actually really, really pleased. I can't actually remember off the top of my head what it was a B-side of. And Daniela, you said it is a beautiful sign, the old Pepsi Cola sign. You described it as old. It's actually a 1993 reconstruction of the 1940 original, which was damaged in a storm. Does that make it more or less a landmark, that it's a semi-facsimile?
Ooh, yeah, that's a very deep and philosophical question.
There are three PhD theses in that. Yeah, just what you've just said, Andrew.
Have I just ruined everything?
Yes.
You haven't. It looks old, it's attractive, and I'm quite happy with it, as long as we don't have a similar situation with the Golden Arches at some point in world history, then that's okay by me.
Well, I think that brings us back to our previous item, because you two actually tried that with one of their stage sets in the late 90s. On that note, we will have to leave it there. Daniela Pellard and Robert Fox, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. That is all for today's episode. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Maria Granina and Charlie Young. Our studio manager was Chris Grimes. There's more music coming up shortly. At 1900, you can hear Daniel Giacopelli with The Entrepreneurs. And there's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. I'll be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.